Welcome to the Cacao Podcast, and we are delighted today to have with us Nigel Pearson, Dr. Nigel Pearson. Nigel worked as a clinician in the DRC with the Anglican Church of Congo between 1991 and 1999. He was District Medical Officer of Boga Medical Zone and Director of Boga Nurse Training Institute. And since leaving, he has maintained very close contacts with the DRC and indeed has helped to form the Semaliki Trust, which works with medical centers in the Eastern DRC. More broadly, he has supported the development of health systems in fragile states, working with health ministries, donors, and UN organizations. Nigel, it's a delight to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Miranda. Great to be with you today.
We are going to be talking about the current Ebola outbreak in the Eastern DRC, but I'd like to just get a sense of the Eastern DRC before we move into the specific outbreak. So, could you just share with us some of your impressions from your recent visits? What are things like? How are things going?
Yeah, so Eastern Congo, I know really well and love very much. And I've got hundreds of friends there, and it's very much a second home. In November, I was there. I traveled to about 15 different places and was looked after beautifully the whole time. That is despite the fact that the challenges people face are immense, and Ebola is a particularly bad challenge, but a lot of the areas with Ebola have extreme insecurity. And we've heard a lot of cases of killing, and there's a lot of displacement still. So the challenges are have been going on really for the last 30 years. And when they had COVID back in 2020, that was more like number 10 on the list of priorities. Ebola is definitely number one because the fatality rate is so high. It's such a terrifying disease. But let's remember that in this context, we have people facing so many different health threats, many other epidemics. Just the thing of getting to health facilities to deliver a baby normally, or to get pediatric care, or to get any care for your chronic diseases. These are ongoing challenges for people in the context of insecurity, a lot of food insecurity, which is exacerbated by both the epidemic and the violence. So people just selling their food to market, getting it from market has put the cost up. So people, their daily lives are, quite a struggle. I could say much more, but I'll keep it brief there. But yeah, they are facing huge challenges, but they do it with an incredibly, welcoming heart and vibrant faith.
I just want to ask a question or two because the conflicts that are happening in the Eastern DRC, those are quite a number of overlapping conflicts, aren't they? It's not a single set of participants or a single set of issues.
It is difficult to understand the context. I would, to try and clarify for listeners, it's the fundamental problem is an inadequacy of governance, of the ability of the Congolese state to provide security for its population. And the Congolese state has never really been able to do that. And that allows many armed groups to flourish, and it allows the neighbors to come in and then there's a whole load of different armed groups who are usually proxies for other people. Sometimes they're local armed militia who are sort of like meant to be protecting the population, but of course they end up preying on the population. There is one group called the ADF there is an Islamist component to that, but primarily it was a rebellion that started against the Ugandan government, but has persisted in Eastern Congo. And then when you've got insecurity, that allows arms groups to flourish, and a lot of it is about control of resources. So we're talking about really one of the richest countries in the world in terms of natural resources. Everything is there in Congo. And of course, lots of bad people want to get their hands on it, and they don't want it to be coming out through normal means. And an example of that would be with these ADF militia around the cocoa harvest time. You'll see people with ripe cocoa outside the houses drying, and the militia would choose that particular period to come into the village to kill people, burn down houses, and steal all the cocoa. So they can be after gold, they can be after diamonds, but they can be after cocoa, they can be after wood. It's a kind of resource war as well, in the context of rather weak governance by the central state. And into that breach steps local organizations. So the negative example is the militia. The positive example is the church, and the church is leading a huge proportion of the social services, so health, education. So the church doesn't just run churches and Bible schools. It runs half of the infrastructure of the Congolese state on behalf of the Congolese state, even though the church doesn't get payment from the Congolese state usually to be able to do that.
And that's the area with which the Semaliki Trust works, isn't it? You're working alongside some of those church-run medical centres.
Yes, exactly right. So we have this Semaliki developed out of the links that I have with partners on the ground. And we partner principally with the Anglican Church, which is a big church in the east of Congo. And we particularly focus on health, because we would love to do education, we would love to do other aspects, but we have finite resources. And the health network of the Anglican Church is huge. So there are, 60, 70, 80 different health facilities. This is health centres, small health posts in villages, and the hospitals, which are growing really fast at the moment. And we're supporting them to do that. We support with infrastructure, we supply money so they can buy drugs and equipment. But above all, our support is enables them to do what they want. So we don't tell them how to use money. They very much, we send them regular tranches so they have a predictable source of income that they can use to buy all the things they might need. And that means them, they're often spending our money to buy tires for the Land Rover, for the Land Cruiser, or they're repairing a vehicle or paying for fuel for a motorbike to get around with, or helping to on a supervisory visit. They're used in multiple ways, and there's always building going on. So every health centre and hospital is some kind of new building, usually started by the community, but a little bit of extra funding can help buying some iron sheets or some cement or paint or some fittings.
That's extremely important, isn't it? Because that kind of funding, which actually enables people and empowers people to do what they can clearly see needs to be done where they are, is rare and difficult to get, is my impression.
It's very hard, and it's very tricky in Central Africa, finding organizations that will be accountable with the money. So for us, the bottom line is, first of all, it's a network of partners that we've known for decades, mostly, and that network of trust is very strong. We are obviously totally insistent on financial transparency, and that is so crucial in these kind of contexts, because many, many development agencies are beset by the problem of corruption locally. And so we get everyone to report on the money. They send photos of their invoices, bills, anything they've purchased, and we double check it as much as we possibly can. And so when we know that they're using the money accountably, even the $1,000 we send to a medical coordination as their sort of flexible fund, we know that it will be well used. And then they make decisions on how they use it. And that really can be very transforming for them, even though it's a relatively small sum of money.
I love the idea of such a relational, trustful way of operating, and it's so important, particularly when people are contending with multiple shocks in a fragile state, to have that sense that it's possible to work in a way that you know will be productive with the support of people who trust you to do so must be hugely significant.
It is all about trusting, respectful relationships, and so it's a sense of respect and honour in both directions, but it is one of empowerment and people making decisions as they see fit. And of course, all our projects are under the authority of the church, so they're working very closely with the church authorities, with the bishops, with the Archbishop's office, and that gives them a sense that they are bound under a sort of a structure that permits them to do their work freely. At the same time, all of the health centres are recognised by the Congolese state. And in fact, we have two areas where the Anglican Church is running the district, the government district health hospital and the district and the zone in one case on behalf of the government. And so they are also under the authority of the Congolese state. And so they have to respect the norms and the targets, the goals that the Congolese state is trying to make in terms of prevention of disease or treatment.
Those relationships of trust are clearly hugely important in all directions. And I suppose they're particularly important when you're dealing with Ebola, where one of the major issues, not only in the DRC, but everywhere that we've seen it occur, has been how do you encourage trust in the medical system at a time when people are very scared and often very confused and worried?
Ebola is a terrifying disease, and the lethality rate has been somewhere between 30 and 60% in this current epidemic. So this epidemic is caused by it's called the Bundibugyo strain, which there's been two previous epidemics in Uganda, but not in Congo. It came rather rapidly. It was very poorly picked up initially, partly because it was a different strain, but partly because of the aid cuts. The international aid cuts have hugely reduced the surveillance capacity that was there before, and that was very disappointing. And so the epidemic was a month of spreading of disease transmission before it was announced. And I think that was because of the capacities, you know, were way down. And so when finally this Ebola epidemic was announced, it had spread over hundreds of kilometres with lots of microepidemics everywhere. And so now we're facing this real difficulty of trying to contain it. It's the question of trust is paramount, because how do you convince somebody who's got a fever to go and get tested for Ebola and then go to an Ebola treatment centre, which must be a really terrifying experience, because you're there with all the nurses and doctors are all, you know, masked up and gowned up. You've seen the images, I'm sure. And the death rate's very high. So if you have Ebola, you know, you might not be coming out alive from that centre. So to get people to willingly come forward when they have a temperature and be tested and go requires an immense amount of trust. And I think they're doing really well on the whole. So they've got epidemics spread across an enormous area. They've had cases over 1,000 kilometres. They've got lots of different Ebola treatment centres. Our projects are not running Ebola treatment centres, but there's one that's about to start doing it. But they've had many cases, and they need to test people, check them for fever first, test, and then they send them on to the Ebola treatment centres. But at the same time, all of the six medical coordinations and the national coordination that we support with the Anglican Church are doing huge amounts in terms of advocacy, of sensibilisation, of getting messaging out. And they're doing this by working with pastors and lay readers and evangelists and Sunday school teachers and other community leaders. They're going out, you know, community by community, giving a huge amount of education. I was talking to Congolese friends yesterday. We had a long call actually, and the national coordinator, Dr. Raymond, he had been traveling near some of the mining areas and going up to the displaced camps, whereas of course it's even harder to control an epidemic because people are so deprived of resources. But getting them to be prepared, you know, to be tested, and also to get all the kind of the means of prevention, all the sort of hand sanitizers and gloves and masks and things in place was really important.
What are the key things that the health system needs to do at present beyond the sensibilization?
So there's obviously what's really important is there's two things. One is the Ebola response needs to be brilliant. The second thing is routine services have to carry on. In terms of the Ebola response, it is being able to rapidly screen everybody who comes into the health centre. So, we sent them a bunch of infrared thermometers so you can scan people. you know, it is a bit, if you have a fever, turn to the right. No fever, turn to the left, because you won't be able to transmit a disease if you've not got a fever in the case of Ebola. It's really unlike COVID. It's not spread by droplet. It's spread by bodily fluids. And so if you're wearing gloves and wearing gowns and things, you won't catch it. But anyone with fever to the right, they are then seen by staff definitely wearing gloves, usually masks. And then they'll be tested, hopefully, if they have enough tests, which there have not been enough tests. They'll test those they can for Ebola and also check their symptoms. And even without a test, if they have symptoms that are suggestive of Ebola, they would then have to go off to the Ebola treatment center. And so they need lots and lots of PPE, and they need a sort of triage system with quarantine facilities in every facility, whether it's a health center or hospital. Now, at the same time, they've got to maintain routine services. And unfortunately, during epidemics like this, by far the highest mortality will be with children, with women, with old people who are not getting routine services. That is what's going to kill people. So it will be diabetics not getting their drugs, hypertensive not getting their drugs, kids with malaria not coming in because they're too scared, the families are too scared to bring them. Women not coming to deliver. And we had a really tragic example of somebody I knew when I was in Congo. She was like 5 years old, and she'd been adopted by this lovely family. Her name was Nema, and she's in her 30s now, and she had 6 children, and she was pregnant. And instead of going to one of the trusted hospitals she would normally have gone to, because of Ebola and because there was a treatment center there, she avoided that, and she went to a kind of not a very good quality clinic, and she died during labor. And this, for me, is always the biggest tragedy of these epidemics, is that the biggest loss of life and suffering comes about through people not getting proper medical care for all the other usual problems. And so all our network of health centers and hospitals have to ramp up and really do more to try and convince people to get out into the community and convince people to keep coming. Yes, they'll be tested for temperature, they'll be tested for Ebola, but actually come in with all the other problems so they're not going to die from all the usual things.
I'm so sorry to hear that, Nigel.
Yeah, I mean, it's very illustrative, unfortunately, and Nema will be one of many, unfortunately, many women and girls who would have, succumbed to obstetrical problems just because they're not getting to proper maternity units.
Amidst all of this, and presumably one of the things that's actually difficult for the medical staff is that they are not only treating people, but they are going to be treating some people that they know, or they're going to be hearing about things that are happening to people they know. So there's a personal element on top of the medical element. What has most inspired you by what you're seeing among the medical staff and within the church?
As far as I've heard, none of our health centres or hospitals have closed. I've not heard of staff leaving post because they're too scared. My impression is they're all working. They're all coming. They're working extra hours. There's no extra pay. They're very dedicated. They are, you know, working flat out to carry on providing services. And there's another Christian hospital called the Centre Médical Évangélique, CME Niankundi, which is at Niankundi, also in Bunia, very famous hospitals. And they unfortunately lost a lot of staff, which was really sad, a doctor, nurses. Fortunately, we've not heard of any of our staff dying from Ebola. There were 2 nurses in one of our hospitals who contracted it, and thank the Lord, they've been healed from it. One of the brilliant evangelists in the church, he had been actually looking after people who'd come from an Ebola area, and they developed fever, and sure enough, they had Ebola. He then went on got Ebola. And, you know, wonderful news that he has been discharged from the Ebola treatment center. So there's a lot of people facing, huge personal risk as well. But of course, all the time we're trying to reinforce the preventive measures, and we sent a big load of PPE. So we're hoping that that's helping as well, with gloves and masks and gowns. And obviously we're very keen to send more equipment and send more money so they can get stuff, anything they might need.
And what about contact tracing? Because that's obviously a huge part of fighting any disease outbreak, but it must be quite difficult in the context.
Yes. So Congo is actually quite good with epidemic disease because they're so experienced. And in fact, Ebola is the place where Congo is the place where Ebola started. and this is now the 17th epidemic, I had the privilege of meeting the director of the Public Health Institute, Professor Muyembe, who was the first person to go and identify Ebola back in 1976. He actually travelled back in the plane with a nun who had Ebola, but of course they didn't know what the disease was. Luckily, he didn't catch it. But their team, the epidemiology, the teams, the capacities are really quite strong within the government and within local government. There's very strong sort of health, the structure that the health system is in principle very good. It's just it's underfunded and not properly supported. But there's brilliant doctors who are very, you know, really good at contact tracing, and they've been doing this. What we're seeing, though, is that 80% of cases coming in, new cases of Ebola, are in people who are not contacts. So what it means is the epidemic bubbles away in villages and the mining communities, and they're spread because someone has had a body that they have been touching. They haven't, you know, disposed of it in the proper way during Ebola and the epidemic. And then or a poorer family who, you know, not, you know, they're too frightened to come in. And then you get a micro epidemic of 5-6 cases. And then those are the kind of cases that are coming. So what we're seeing is, rather than thinking of it as one epidemic, it's an epidemic across a huge area, and there's going to be thousands of micro epidemics popping up, killing quite a few people. Some of those will come to the centre, some won't. And then it's spread when someone moves a body or someone who's sick travels to the next town or the next village. And then you get another micro epidemic with 4 or 5 cases before people can jump on it and do the contact tracing.
What would be the thing that would cause you the greatest concern about its spread?
We've been very concerned the whole way through this epidemic that it had spread so widely before it was announced. And I've actually been very impressed by how they're doing, that it hasn't sort of, it's not been in a runaway situation. So it's going to take a long time. I think it will be 6 months to a year because of the thing I was describing of the micro epidemics everywhere. Before they can finally contain it, because what they've now got to do is follow up every one of those little micro epidemics. It's not like one epidemic. So you need public health staff across the whole of this area. The minute there's signs of a case, people have got to go and jump on it. So I think the fear is a lot of Ebola is spreading in the mining communities. So I think the government need to address that. I think they need to be much stricter in terms of the hygiene conditions, and reduce some of the mining perhaps during, you know, to get it under control rapidly. I think there are a lot of screening places, but a lot more screening places on public transport networks. And then just, you know, as much sensibilisation of the population to get people to come the minute they've got a temperature. But I'm not sort of scared of it being runaway in terms of the numbers, as long as all the messaging can carry on, as long as all our partners can carry on doing their work. And there's a very good network of church-based communities and hospitals who are working really tirelessly, not just in the Anglican Church, many, many other churches are doing fantastic work. So I think that communities are so strong in Congo, that there's a very good network of communication, and that works really efficiently. So as long as people are able to keep doing that, then I think they will get it under control. But of course, they need a lot more resourcing to do that, and they need stronger leadership nationally and internationally in support of them.
And that, in a sense, comes to the question of what we can do as Christians here in the UK. What are the options open to us to help support this example of faith in action?
Yes, so I think prayer is really important. I think praying for partners in Congo, praying for the church, the leadership, that they can keep tirelessly giving out the messages, and that they won't tire, you know, quickly, that they'll have enough resources themselves, they'll have enough money and be able to get hold of food, you know, to keep their families going, because that is really quite challenging, because the economy's obviously really hit. In terms of supporting, obviously, organisations like Semeliki Trust, we can get stuff there, and we get it there very, very directly. There are other international agencies on the ground, like WHO are there in Bunia, for example, and they're doing good work to support the state. And then through other networks, if people, you know, have friends who are working or know of Congolese people who are working, and they can send, you know, small amounts of money to support a health centre or hospital, of course, that can help as well. And the other aspect, I guess, is also, as Christians, I think we do need to get our voice out there, that our governments become more compassionate again, because I think the cuts to the aid budgets have been really scandalous and really totally not achieving anything. I think in terms of contributing, we're talking a lot about security these days. I think the development funding is one of the best ways of providing security in the world. And so that our international agencies can step up, UN agencies, government agencies, they need more money. So I think we need to really advocate as Christians that the taps of international development funding are turned on again, because that loss has been very keenly felt, and it's having a real impact on increasing poverty and stopping good disease control, things that we're all very good at doing, we love doing, but we're really not able to do that now in the same way that we were before all the aid cuts.
It's important to hear that, Nigel, because I think often the aid cuts seem to be, for politicians, consequence-free. And understanding what the actual consequences are and enabling people to go in and say, well, actually, these are the consequences. And as a Christian, I'm very concerned. It's extremely important. Can I ask you, you've said a number of things which are really positive about the way that the church is acting, the way that the medical staff are acting, about the strength of the networks in the DRC and the ways in which people are working together to get out messaging and to undertake practical steps. Could you give me one example, just to close, of one person or one action that has really inspired you?
Well, I guess the answer is not such a dramatic answer, but I think it's the fact that, you know, we raised money and sent a very large load of PPE, and it was just their networking that they had in advance spoken to the customs people, because normally we get tariffs slapped on, import duties when they go into the country. All that was removed because people had been talking for days beforehand to the customs people. They prepared it in advance. They then shifted the stuff. It's gone to, you know, 40 different places within a week. It's got out to everywhere. People are so pleased to have it, but they themselves are then using it, and it's enabling them to do their job. So I think for the example really of the people who are leading that response, so particularly Dr. Raymond, who's the national coordinator for the Service Medical of the Anglican Church, he and Prosper, he's the administrator, they have been, you know, ensuring that the supplies are getting everywhere in a very transparent way. They're in communication with all the coordinators every day. They themselves have been travelling, you know, to the displaced camps. They've been working with the union of the Fathers Union, which they have in Congo, getting the message out, going village by village into different communities, different churches, different centres, giving that message tirelessly. And they are just one example of all that the coordinators and the health staff are doing on the ground. I was thinking of Dr. David, actually up in Aru Hospital, who, you know, they've had cases. It's very scary for the staff, but they, you know, just by putting in place the proper ways of receiving patients, putting on masks, putting on gowns and things, but obviously being able to provide love and compassion to people with Ebola, suspect cases, and then moving them on quickly while protecting other patients, protecting staff, making sure the staff follow all the guidelines. You know, this is really, it's saving lives, and it means the medical people can keep working in their health centres without fear and doing a really good job. And the fact that they are still showing God's love in action when they themselves are being paid so little, that they're there every day doing an absolutely brilliant job. And it's really inspiring to hear from them about what they're doing during this epidemic.
It's inspiring to hear you talk about them, Nigel, and it's very inspiring also what you and the others in Semaliki Trust are doing to build bridges and enable people to do this work that they are called to do and do so well. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Miranda. It's been delightful to have this chat with you.